Health and Human Services wrongfully denied Ms. Winslow's application for Medicaid benefits. This morning, I'd like to first discuss how the department failed to follow its regulations with regard to her real estate, and second, argue why it is that the state cannot bring up at this late stage for the first time an argument that the denial really had nothing to do with her real estate, but with something else entirely. Now, Your Honors, the default position under Medicaid eligibility regulations is that a person's home is excluded from his or her resource calculation. Now, obviously that changes when an individual moves from a house to a nursing facility, and the nursing facility becomes that individual's home. However, even in that situation, the regulations give the individual time to sell the house before interfering with that individual's Medicaid benefits.
Does that residential property stop being a home under the regulations?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that's correct. And in that situation, when a home is no longer excluded by the homestead exemption, the regulations require the department to give the applicant at least 6 months to sell the real estate, again, before the Medicaid benefits are interfered with. Alternatively, if the department is unsure whether the individual has a legal authority to sell the real estate, then the department is to give that individual 60 days to initiate court action. In this case, Ms. Winslow owned real estate. That real estate put her, if counted, the value of it, over the resource guidelines. However, the department never gave her 6 months, it never gave her 60 days. It simply denied her application on the basis that her resources exceeded the program guidelines. Now, the reason that the department gave for this determination was that the property was held in irrevocable trust. As we describe at length in our brief, the distinction based on a property being in revocable trust is arbitrary. It's contrary to state regulations, it's contrary to federal law, and in fact, I would argue it is unconstitutional.
Who was the settlor of the trust?
The settlor of the trust in this case was Levita Winslow.
Did she have the authority then to revoke that trust?
Under the trust, yes, Your Honor, she clearly does.
And was that stated in the trust?
Yes, Your Honor.
And did the department have the trust at some point?
The department had that trust well before the effective date of this application, yes, Your Honor. Put simply, the irrevocable trust has no effect, no practical or legal effect during the settlor's lifetime, and there's no reason that this distinction should make any difference under the Medicaid rules. Now, Your Honors, perhaps realizing that the department's original rationale had some issues, the state has apparently abandoned this argument, and in its appeal brief, has not referenced that at all, and instead references or argues that the only basis to uphold the denial was some question about whether Ms. Winslow failed to respond to verification requests. Now, the problem with bringing this up at this point, first of all, is that this wasn't argued in front of the administrative law judge. And this court's precedent has stated that if it's not argued and passed upon adjudicated upon by the administrative law judge, it cannot be brought up in front of the Court of Appeals. This argument was also not the basis of the district court's opinion. And more importantly, this simply was not the basis ever of the actual denial of Ms. Winslow's application.
What did the district court find?
The district court found, Your Honor, that Ms. Winslow's assets exceeded the resource guidelines because the district court essentially agreed with the department's original arguments, that because the property was held in a revocable trust, she didn't own it. Now, this put it into a strange loophole because the property was available to her, in other words, it was counted as an asset, but she didn't own it for the purposes of being able to get that 6 months. And this is the loophole that we argue is unfair and results in an unfair situation for her. I want to point out with regard to the...
Mr. Gunsel,
yes.
In under the law of real estate and trusts, the trustee would be the holder of legal title to the real estate, and the beneficiaries would be the holders of equitable title. If, as trustee, she held the legal title in that fiduciary capacity, isn't it in fact the case that as an individual, she did not hold legal title to that real estate? And if you agree with all of that, does that make any difference?
Yes, Your Honor, I think that is correct, that if she was not trustee, she did not hold legal title. I will tell you, this was I think, a 100-page trust, so it's a little bit complicated, but it does appear, in fact, she was both a trustee and a beneficiary and the settlor of the trust, so that leads to some question there. But more importantly, as you pointed out, Your Honor, she retains equitable title. So even if she didn't retain any sort of legal title, the appellant's position would be that retaining equitable title is exactly what's necessary here.
And that would rest, I take it, upon, since it would depend upon whether she's a beneficiary, that would depend upon her right of revocation.
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right.
Now, under equitable title...
Did she have right of revocation?
Yes, Your Honor, she did.
Is that set forth in the trust?
That's set forth in the trust, Your Honor, yes, and it's also set forth in the Nebraska Probate Code, which describes the powers of a settlor of a revocable trust that can revoke the trust at any time.
So, in plain speak, she had a power to dispose of it.
Yes, Your Honor, that's absolutely right. Now, even if she only had the equitable title, it's important to look at federal law. So under the federal SSI rules, Supplemental Social Security Income rules, the requirement is that Medicaid rules can be no more restrictive than the SSI rules. Under the SSI rules, as cited in our brief, the provisions for the equivalent homestead exemption clearly address someone who only has equitable title on a property. So even if it's the case, as we argue that it's not, that the Nebraska regulations don't allow this sort of exemption for someone only with equitable title, then in that case, those regulations are in conflict and superseded by the federal regulations and law, which clearly apply to someone with equitable title. Back to the point where, as I suspect the state will argue, is that this has nothing to do with real estate. This is about a verification request. I want to point out that at the administrative law hearing, the department's representative was asked, if this property that's in question, if this was an excluded asset, in other words, not counted, in that case, would Ms. Winslow qualify for Medicaid benefits? And the answer was, yes, I believe so. That is found up page 12 of the transcript. So there was no response of, well, we didn't get the verification we needed or anything along those lines. The answer was, if this property is excluded, then yes, she qualifies. Your Honor, ultimately, there's a reason that the regulations allow Medicaid applicants time to sell their real estate. And that's because otherwise, these individuals would incur financial hardship during the often lengthy process of selling the real estate. There is no legal or equitable reason to impose this hardship on Ms. Winslow simply because her real estate was held in a revocable trust, a common estate planning document. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Smith, good morning to you.
Please court, James D. Smith, Assistant Attorney General, appearing for the appellee. This is an Administrative Procedure Act appeal from the district court's order affirming the denial of Medicaid.
I should have asked Mr. Gunzel this, but is she now receiving the benefits she wishes, and are we just talking about past money not paid?
You took the words out of my mouth because the conclusion of my sentence would have been affirming denial of Medicaid eligibility for a period of 5 months. She has been Medicaid eligible since January 1, I believe, of 2017.
But how did she become eligible?
I'm sorry.
How did she become eligible at that time?
She became eligible, and real estate's treated differently. She became eligible by signing IM-1. It's a form for selling one's real estate. It's essentially a good faith agreement that I'll get rid of the real estate within 6 months, and if I don't, then you can come back to recoup Medicaid benefits. Judge...
Why could she have not signed that in September?
Well, I think that gets into the issue of the department's requesting information and information's not being provided in a timely manner as the department is trying to figure out what is this real estate. Who owns it? What's the status of it?
What information did the department not have in September regarding the ownership of the real estate?
Well, I would say it's going to appear from the judge. The judge actually describes that in his order, but what he describes is that essentially the department sent information requesting more information on the trust, on the real estate, who owns it, what's the status of it. And we see in the record repeated requests for more information. And that's one thing I think is important to understand is when Winslow files a request for a hearing, they specifically claim it's an irrevocable trust. And you can find that on the record at E1, page 4, paragraph 5C of the
request. Did the department have the revocable trust in its possession before September of 2016?
They had a very lengthy document as far as...
Labeled a trust?
Labeled as a trust. It appears that Winslow was claiming it was an irrevocable trust because that appears in the request for a fair hearing. When you look
at the document called a revocable trust? Doesn't it grant authority for Ms. Winslow to revoke the trust?
Well, it's her trust, and she's asserting in her request
for... They've got a copy of it. Is it their duty to decide first who owns the property? Is that
the
department's duty?
It's the duty of the department. Well, it's the duty of the applicant to provide information so the department can make the determination of what is the trust, what's in the trust,
and she did so? She provided the document.
She eventually did, and the judge's order reflects that all of the requested information is provided, I think it's December 22nd, 23rd, 26th.
Back to my question, what were they lacking to determine the ownership of the property? Was it the deed? And was that ever provided that shows that the trust owns the property? Because they had the trust document in September.
She didn't
provide anything new other than the deed from her power of attorney deeding it back to her name in December. Well, that was the only thing that changed after the initial denial. Is that correct?
I don't know that that's the only thing that was changed. What they did eventually provide was what was in the trust, who owned the deed or who owned the property represented it, but they were still represented it as an irrevocable trust. Now, if I could, the department's letter, if you look at Exhibit 12, page 3, on October of 2016, the department is requesting more information on the claimed revocable trust. Now, the difference between revocable and irrevocable, if you're claiming this is somehow a revocable trust or she doesn't own or have it available to her, she's entitled to benefits as of the time she applied. Real estate is treated different because it was owned or available to her, then she could become prospectively eligible and only upon signing that form IM-1. She didn't sign that form until December 31, 2016. By regulations, once she signed it, she became prospectively eligible the first day of the next month. So
it's her failure to provide the IM one form prior to that date? Is that the failure?
The district judge, and again, I'd refer the court to the judge's description. I think Judge Colburn does a good job on pages 9 of his order, pointing out that contrary to the argument, regulations don't require the department to provide the form upon determining resources would exceed Medicaid guidelines. The regulations require the department to obtain the signature on the form determining that the individual has legal authority to liquidate the property. So once the department gets all the information, then makes that determination, she has legal authority to liquidate, then they provide the form, she then signs the form, but all of those determinations aren't made until December. She doesn't sign it until December, which means she still is not going to be prospectively eligible until January. Because real estate's different.
Under the trust, did she have the authority to liquidate the real estate?
Frankly, it's an 800-page document. I couldn't tell you that, but I think it's also colored by the fact that if you're applying and you're claiming it's a revocable trust and it's an 800-page document, why is the department going to say we're not going to believe you? And eventually you keep providing the information, they eventually make the determination of who does have authority to basically sign the form.
And who was that?
Would have been Winslow or agent authority on her behalf, who was, I think it was eventually was her power of attorney.
So Winslow had the authority to sign the trust?
Well, she clearly had authority when the trustee transfers the property to her, which happens in December. Once she transfers the trustee transfers the property to Winslow, Winslow clearly has the authority at that time to sign the IM-1, her power of attorney or agent on her behalf, then signs the form, makes her prospectively eligible January 1st.
On the deed, you're saying it's transferred to Winslow. In what capacity?
I don't recall if it
as
was...
As an individual person?
Well, that was my understanding, but...
That was transferred by whom?
I believe it was transferred by the trustee.
And that's not Ms. Winslow? That's her power of attorney?
Power of attorney,
her
trustee.
Daughter?
Person who's got authority to transfer the property under the trust.
But Ms. Winslow was also a trustee.
Well, it doesn't make a lot of difference if she's not signing it. I mean, they're making it clear as of that time property has now been transferred. Winslow clearly has authority, her power of attorney. The department makes that determination. Once they make that determination, once they got all of the information as of December, Winslow's attorney even then says, okay, give us the IM-1 form. It's provided. She signs it, but it still makes... It's still that prospective eligibility, because the entire case is about if you go in and say right off the bat, we don't have any ownership interest in real estate, or it's not available to her, then she would have been available, eligible in September. When you are not providing information and it gets colorable as to what's in the trust, what's the status of the real estate, who has what, and the ultimate situation is it's real estate, it's either owned by her or available to her as of September, that would have made her prospectively ineligible for 6 months.
I'm confused as to the time frame between September and December. What is the state's position? She had the power to dispose of it, or she did not? Or she had the power to dispose of it, and in addition, there was some kind of durable power of attorney, so there were a couple of them who could have disposed of it?
The state's position is ultimately upon the department determining that there is authority to transfer the property that's available to her, the form has to be signed. Once the form is signed, you are only eligible for the first and,
so
of the
what
next
was
month.
The view of the department between September and December? Was it everybody befuddled about where the power to dispose of lay?
I think
were they hesitant to read the 100-page document?
What's that? I think the burden's on the applicant to provide the information requested, clarify, explain, and
so
I think
your position is they should have filed a brief with the trust document?
So they hand over a document that says revocable trust. I'm the settlor. I'm a trustee. It may or may not also be a beneficiary. And the department is overwhelmed.
And the department is what's in the trust. Because you say there is a Mankato property. Is it in the trust? Is it not in the trust? What's the status of that property? And you see letters requesting more information. It's not being provided. Eventually is provided in December. The department then makes the determination once you finally provide the information, which is her obligation to do. And once the department makes the determination that, yes, she can transfer this property, then the form is provided, it's signed, and she becomes prospectively eligible in January.
Did the department advise her to revoke the trust?
I believe the record does reflect that that was one of the advisements, if you're...
Wouldn't that indicate she had the authority to revoke the trust, and it was a revocable trust?
I think it would reflect that the department would be able to decide, once the trust is gone, there's no confusion here.
At the time in September, I'm not talking about December.
Sure.
But the September application, was it clear from the materials provided by the applicant who was actually serving as trustee, as opposed to who might be an authorized trustee under the document?
The record reflects that this was not clear to the department. That's why the department keeps asking for information. Clarify the trust, clarify the status of the real estate. Who owns it? Who has authority to do what? And if you're not providing and responding to requests for information, to me it seems somewhat difficult to say it's their fault that I didn't provide the information that they requested and wanted so they can ultimately make the determination. And once they make the determination that, okay, this real estate does make you ineligible, transfers title to the real estate and signs the form.
And they're asking all these questions because they can't figure it out on the basis of the information provided. Is that the state's position?
That would be at least what the record would reflect, is the department was not clear to them. They didn't want it hurt, for example, I think it reflects, they don't want her to go sell her house if it's determined it's really not necessary. In other words, don't tell a person to go sell a house or some real estate to become Medicaid eligible and then determine it wasn't necessary to do that in the first place.
Wouldn't signing the IM-1 form give them 6 months to make a good faith effort to sell the house if necessary?
It would if the one signing the form had the authority to sell the property.
Which goes back to the trust, it says who has the authority.
Gets back to who's actually got authority over this particular piece of property to sell it. Gets deeded back to her, makes it clear who has authority at that point under the regs. Here's IM-1, gets promptly signed. But if you apply and you're going to be ineligible because of that real estate, the fight is on. Am I going to be prospectively or currently eligible? And I would say when you're requesting a hearing claiming it's an revocable trust, you have documents from the department asking for information on this claim of a revocable trust, I think all of that would reflect there's a big difference. It's whether it's eligible to you if it's a revocable trust or irrevocable trust. If you're claiming it's revocable, need more information to explain that. Eventually, information is provided in December, and that theory goes down the drain.
I think either you misspoke or perhaps you
probably did.
the request for a hearing specified that it was, or stated, claimed that it was an irrevocable trust?
Yes.
Okay, and I think you may have just said the opposite.
Okay, no, the request for a hearing before the department makes the claim it was an irrevocable trust.
All right.
That's on Exhibit 1. H4, paragraph 5C, that's consistent with the department previously in October requesting more information on the claimed revocable trust, which is it revocable, irrevocable? That's an issue. Now, by the time the hearing's all done, that horse is out of the barn. But I don't think you can go back and blame the department for saying, gee, you should have figured all of this out when we were claiming, even when we're requesting a hearing, that it's an irrevocable trust.
Thank you.
With that, my closing comment is my career. I've done one speeding case, one DUI trial. I've now done one Medicaid appeal. And if I conclude my career with this is the last one I do, I will be a happy person. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
1 minute 49 seconds.
1 minute and 49 seconds. Mr. Gunzel.
Yes, Your Honor. I want to point out a couple of things. One is the reason the IM-1 form couldn't be signed prior to December was because the department was telling LaVita Winslow that she couldn't sign the IM-1 form until the property had been transferred back into her name. So in other words, they said if there's a trust, you can't sign an IM-1 form. So it's a, it, well.
Mr. Gunzel, yes. At the time, back in the September window, when all of this information is being provided, what does the department know about who is actually serving as trustee? Not what the document says, the trustee or successor or whatever, but what do they know about who is really serving as trustee?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that most of the communication between the department, in fact, I'm sure the communication between the department and Ms. Winslow's representatives at that time had been through her power of attorney, Vicki Garman, I believe. And that had been up to that point. Who was listed as a trustee and also the POA for Levita Winslow.
So couldn't the department, if all of this communication is going on with someone else, couldn't the department very reasonably conclude, even though this document says she's trustee, she may not be acting as trustee?
Your Honor, I don't believe the department could reasonably ascribe any legal significance to the fact that she wasn't acting as trustee. If the whole basis of our argument, or one of the bases, is that the revocable trust is irrelevant in these contexts. So I don't think it changes anything. Even if she's not acting as trustee, it's not on the record, but let's say she has dementia and she's not acting at all. That doesn't change the fact that this is a revocable trust. And she can revoke it at any point in time. She retains equitable title, Your Honor. And with that, Your Honor, I see I'm out of time.
I do have one more question. Please. What information was provided after September through December? The department's asking for more information. Verifications are out there. What information is provided that changes other than the IM-1 form?
There is no information that is provided relevant to the property and the trust that changes anything other than the IM-1 form and the deed.
The new deed.
The new deed that's done.
Transfers it out of the trustee to back to Ms. Woods.
That's correct. Prior to September, there had been a prior Medicaid application, and during that application, the property information, the ownership information about that property, that it was owned by the trust, had been provided, and the entire copy of the trust had been provided. Now, this was a complicated case, there's to be sure, and there was a lot of discussion back and forth, but the department has the obligation to determine, under the regulations, to determine who owns the property. The department has the obligation to obtain the signature on the IM-1 form. And essentially, I think Your Honors were correct in saying they were befuddled. And that's not an excuse to, when somebody comes in this situation, to not give them an IM-1 form. Ultimately, Your Honors, if the department's approach to this case carries the day, someone who applies for Medicaid whose home is in a real estate is in a revocable trust will be treated differently than somebody whose home is in a not is is titled in that person's name. That both violates federal law and it violates all sense. Thank you very much.
The next case of the day is State versus Gary L. Mann.